You're listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. Find out how you can join us for a live show at the Cactus at cactuscafe.org.
Usually I introduce these wonderful men and tell you all of their accolades and where they teach and all the books that they wrote, but you have passed by the books. Maybe you picked up a book of Art Markman's, Bring Your Brain to Work. So tonight I thought I'd do something a little bit different when introducing them, and I asked them to bring seven words that described them to share with you tonight. So who gets to go first? And they didn't have to rhyme. This is a very low pressure.
I thought they had to rhyme.
They didn't have to rhyme, but they can. They have to be serious. This is going to stick with you. We're going to make t-shirts.
We're serious, okay.
Out of these shirts, out of these words.
Are you going to start? Okay, I'll go. Let's get this over with. Okay. Lucky.
Lucky.
Loved.
Aww.
Funny. At least I like to think so.
Yes.
Loud.
Loud.
Tenacious. How many is that?
That's five.
Jeez.
I know.
Tasteful.
Oh.
Yeah, that's a lie. But it's all I can think of.
That's a lie.
And here we go. And grateful.
Grateful.
There we go. Whoa.
Those are good.
Come on.
I feel like we all know you a little better now.
All right, there you go.
Okay, so 12 words. So this is, and there's research that goes with this.
Is there?
Yeah. So notice all of Bob's descriptors were individual descriptors, right? No. This is
science,
there's,
man.
There's a lot of work on self-concept that distinguishes between people who have relatively more of an individual, independent self-construal or an interdependent self-construal, where if you answer the question "Who are you?" with descriptors, the more words that you use that are just about you, the
Bob.
More independently you think of yourself compared to everybody else, and the more that you use words that relate yourself to other people, the more interdependently you think of yourself. This is why I wanted Bob to go first. Because otherwise he would have rethought his list.
Okay.
But I'll give you. So for me, right, because I was thinking about this. Some of mine are clearly going to be the independent type. So I would funny. I'll go with funny too. Why not? Narcissistic
but in a good way.
There's a one item narcissism scale. This is a real thing also. Brad Bushman created the one item narcissism scale on a scale from 1 to 7. How narcissistic are you? And it turns out that scale works.
Yeah.
Narcissists are aware of their narcissism. Bob's about a 5, but
I wasn't aware of that, but okay.
You were. So let's say funny, narcissistic, curious. So that's another independent one.
Yeah.
But I would also say I'm a teacher and a mentor. Uh-huh. And a parent.
I see you're more noun oriented. I'm more
adjective oriented.
Yes.
Well, because you often need the nouns to describe relations.
Oh.
And that's how you get the relationship between you and somebody else.
Okay.
White haired.
Is white haired one
and,
word?
And I'm not being completely facetious about that from a self concept standpoint, because I started going gray at 13. And seriously, and by the time I graduated from high school, I'd noticeably gray hair. And so I'm finally aging into this, but for a long time, that was like I was the white-haired guy.
Yeah.
You know, who...
Not even on Game of Thrones.
Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That I knew of, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that those are, that's a very good explanation, so thank you for those seven words.
Okay.
Yes. So we came to talk about this book, Bring Your Brain to Work.
Yes. I have to say, though,
yeah.
What's really important, the last time we did A Views and Brews was back in the fall. And since that time, Rebecca had a baby and
True.
Art had a book.
Yes. We
so,
both gave birth.
That's right. The progeny have arrived, some more complicated than others.
Some more painful than
yes,
others.
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
And since I've never written a book, I, you know, I can't really empathize, but I'll try.
But really, let's just say, here's the way to say it, okay? With books, the proposal process is harder than the than it is when you're creating a baby. But sending the book off is easier than giving birth.
Yeah.
So that's
So he hears.
I checked into the hospital at 4:30. This is a true story. I had Paco at 4:34.
So. Wow.
Not one to waste time.
No.
She.
We gotta get this
or
done.
Or Paco.
And you know
who's already in college.
I think this is true. Super smart. It's funny that you mentioned this, though, because before we get to the book, as we get to the book, I heard a quote the other day that that was, we don't have that many threshold experiences anymore, you know? But I want to talk about these threshold experiences, because it's interesting. Jobs are one of those. You know, you go in, you come out a completely different person. And sometimes you go in a different person and, you know, you come out a little bit more yourself. So talk about this idea of where we're at with work, who this book is for and why you wrote it, why you wanted to kind of get it out there.
So it turns out, right, that despite the bumper sticker that says nobody lies on their deathbed wishing they'd spent another day at the office, the fact is that most of us are going to spend 75,000 hours plus or minus at work. Yeah. And so what that means for us is that it had better add up to something. It had better matter. And when you look around at people, you know, often the people who have careers that were meaningful, when you talk to them later, they feel like they stumbled into the thing that was meaningful for them. And there's always a certain amount of luck and serendipity that goes into having a wonderful career, being open to the potential experiences. But the fascinating thing to me was, you know, I just finished 28 years of teaching at the college level this year, and I mean, I'm still teaching, but this was the end of the 28th year, and what I realized is, what makes people successful in their careers has almost nothing to do with what they majored in, right? It's all of this other stuff, and it's not that what you majored in doesn't matter. You know, we learn stuff in college, but so much about success is about getting along with people, working with effectively with others, learning to navigate that environment, learning to become a leader, developing strategies to allow you to be productive in that environment, figuring out what your values are so that you can have a career that fits those values. And we don't talk about those in classes. Sometimes you talk about them late at night with the aid of substances of various kinds, but not in class. And so there's all of this stuff that leads to career success. And a lot of it is actually related to things that have been studied in psychology and more broadly in the fields of cognitive science. And yet, most people don't learn a lot of that stuff. And so it's not like you couldn't learn things that might help you to navigate a career. It's that we don't tend to teach those things. And when we do teach some of those things, we don't teach them in a way that makes it clear to people that this relates to their career. And I've been writing for the last 5 or 6 years for Fast Company. And they asked me if I would write for them. I said, sure, except I have no idea what to write for you. So if you'll feed me topics, I'll write stuff. And so they just kept asking me questions that were of the form of, like, I just screwed up at work, what do I do? Or I had a really bad interview, you know, or I got asked a question, I don't know what to do with it. And so I would write these 500 word things, and then I was like, wait a second, people are worried about this stuff. So what if we put it all in one place and really tried to make it somewhat coherent? So that was sort of where the book came from.
And Bob, you said when we were talking about what we're going to talk about tonight, you're like, we have to talk about communication. Like, that's the best part of the book. Or I love that part of the book. So why that part?
Well, I mean, all the book is great. But what's interesting to me about contextualizing things about the way we communicate with other human beings in a workplace really generalizes to lots of other places besides work. I mean, and I think art is masterful, don't listen to this, at describing things that, you know, if you read the psychology literature, it's somewhat abstruse and a little bit hard to get into. But what art's able to do is articulate things in such a way that you understand what are the critical features of effective communication, or whatever the topic happens to be, effective goal setting, whatever he covers in the book. And there are many things he covers in the book. But I think what's important about this is that, you know, as Art's saying, we tend not to say, well, we're going to teach people how to do this, because often we attribute this to some immutable aspect of personality. You know, we say, well, this guy's good with people, but he doesn't know how to do integral calculus, so we'll teach him that. Right? But you have somebody who learns integral calculus who's bad with people, and say, well, what are you going to do? You know? Well, I think this is the thing, right? I mean, I think what Art's book and all the interactions that Art and I have together when we're giving talks and other kinds of things illustrates that actually there are things to know, and there are actionable ways of understanding the world that helps all of us, right? If interact with people more effectively, whether it's a friend or a spouse or a loved one or an employer or an employee. And I think that's just a huge part of what makes working with other people successful, is being able to communicate effectively.
And so let's start at the beginning a little bit.
Yeah.
You're figuring out my values, you know, your values, what kind of job, what kind of career you want to have. Like, what are some good ways to start thinking about that?
So there's this wonderful research by a guy named Shalom Schwartz, who's studied value systems around the world. And it and when you look at the value systems, what you discover is there's about 10 values that are distinct that when you look across cultures that people tend to hold. And some of the values that people hold are really fostered by a particular culture. And then there are values that people acquire over through conversations and through thought. And then there are just, you know, motivations that we have that come from some of the way that we're wired as individuals, you know, that manifest themselves as personality characteristics that also become part of these value systems. And so if you look at the values that people have, there are values. I mean, some people value hedonism is one of the values, pleasure. Right. Well, if you look around, there are party people out there. Their goal in life, what they value more than anything else, is pleasurable experiences. And you know, and for those people,
and who can argue with that?
Right. Well, exactly. I mean, I'm a fan of pleasure, but I'm not sure it's an overriding life goal for every moment. But I definitely know people who've structured their lives. That's what they want. There are people who really want adventure in their lives. One of the things I was able to do with this book that I'd never done before with the book was using social media. I just posted questions. And it's amazing what stories people are willing to tell you when you post a question on social media. And so, one of my favorite stories was a guy who said he went to a career fair in his 20s, and they gave everybody one of those tests to look at, you know, what do you think you're going to like to do, and after they took the test, there was a whole bunch of people standing around, and one of them, and they were joking about one of the particular questions on the test that was about, would you want to have a job that brought you to war zones, and they were laughing about that. He said, and that's the moment he realized that he wasn't like everyone else. Because that was actually something that was exciting for him. And he ended up in a career with the State Department going to war zones and loved it. Because that was that value resonated for him. Then there are people, you know, achievement is another one of these values where, you know, and often, I mean, there are segments of our culture that drive us towards, you know, your value in life should be success and being in front of people. And you know, it's fascinating too. So I had another story about a guy who had internalized that value from his parents. And from his college and everything else. And so he took a job that was one of these jobs. It was a prestigious job. It had opportunities for advancement. He was excited about it. And then like a year into it, he was like, I'm going to the Peace Corps. And he did. He went off to the Peace Corps because he realized his value as he really began to reflect on it was much more about benevolence, about doing good things for other people. And he did the Peace Corps for a couple of years and then came back and shifted his career path towards something that really enabled him to work with others and to engage with others. And so there's two things that are important here. One is, what makes people happy at work isn't really the particular tasks you do day to day. It's really about, do I feel two things? Do I feel like this work is about something bigger than just me? And do I feel like I can express who I am through the work that I do? And people who have that capacity at work feel much better about the things that they do. They're excited to get up in the morning. But we also have to recognize that your values will shift over the course of your life. And so things that are really important to you at one time will become different at other times of in your life. And you have to remember to kind of check in with yourself every once in a while and say, you know what, actually, this thing that fed me for the first 20 years of my career, it's not working so much for me anymore, and I'm going to need to make a shift.
Yeah. You know, something else that Art addresses in the book, which I think is important to talk about, is the idea of leadership. You know, one of the values of our institution here, leadership is one of the big elements that's promulgated as what we need to be doing, students, helping them learn skills of leadership.
And every student is going to be a leader.
Yeah, exactly.
No followers.
Exactly. Exactly. It's going to be a very crowded leadership field. But what's interesting about that is that that conception of leadership is very narrowly defined. It's as if, you know, what leadership is about is telling other people what they need to be doing. And what the book does is very intelligently and skillfully talks about leadership as a personal characteristic that goes beyond what you order others to do who are in your charge. And maybe you could talk about that a little bit, about just the idea of leadership more broadly.
So I was lucky enough to be on a committee here
at
the university.
That's Bob's word.
Right. Well, I can be. I'm occasionally
lucky.
Too.
I share my adjectives.
And great. She's caring and sharing as well. But I was lucky enough to be on a committee where we actually had to think a little bit about leadership education here at the university. And while leadership is a core value of the university, one of the things that we recognize is that there are a lot of skills that go into that, not all of which require that you aim towards a particular pinnacle place on the org chart of some place. But, you know, so among other things, right, leadership involves helping to develop the people around you, for example. I mean, part of being a leader is trying to make sure that we share a common set of goals, that we have a sense of civic responsibility, that we learn to communicate and learn to have the difficult conversations that, you know, when you think about communication in the role of leadership, it's, you know, it's easy to lead when everything is going well. What's hard is sitting down with people who are struggling or working with an organization that is struggling and really trying to communicate the changes needed and to do it in a way that is sensitive to where people are, humane but still direct. You know, it turns out it's not humane to tell people they're doing a great job when they're not. You know, that's the people need to get good feedback, but it's hard if you've ever had to sit in front of someone and tell them that they're not doing a good job. You know, you can agonize over that conversation for hours beforehand and then not want to say the words when they're sitting there. You want to, you know, mumble them. And there's, you know, and so, you know, being engaging but also direct. I mean, there's value in a simple declarative sentence that makes the statement that there's going to have to be a change.
Yeah, and I think this is a great example of how leadership is something that has an ebb and flow to it, right? I mean, in many of our personal relationships and our family relationships, people take on a leadership role, right? And even sometimes people who are supposed to be the ones we're in charge of assume a leadership role because they tell us things that we'd rather not hear. And I think, you know, a lot of personal responsibility can be placed under the umbrella of leadership. I mean, when we see things that need to be done, and before someone else asks or before someone offers an incentive to do it, we just recognize that needs to be done and we do it, not because we're trying to be an exemplar for other people, but because it's something that needs to be done and we take the initiative to do that. That's a characteristic of leadership that has nothing to do with directing the lives of other people.
And a related piece is this notion of resilience. As everyone has to learn, and this is an important part of ultimately being a leader. Anyone who has any amount of success in their career has bad days, sometimes really bad days. You know, I mean, one way to say this is, you know, everything is two steps forward and one step back. But it is what you do on the days that you've taken a step back that determine the size of the steps forward that you're able to take. And so, you know, what does that mean? Well, it means A, not carrying around the anger or hurt or frustration that comes with the step back for too long. You're allowed to feel it for a certain amount of time. You know, when if you don't, I mean, I recently applied for a position within the university I was excited about and I did not get it. Didn't get it. Yeah. And it hurt.
Shocking.
It hurt. And you know what? You gotta let that happen. It's, you know, if there's something you want and you put yourself out there, when you don't get it, it's gonna hurt. That's okay. You don't have to hide that, okay? But fairly soon after that, you gotta say, all right, what's next? It's time to move forward. And you have to be willing to look at realistically what happened and say, oh, I gotta change this. I have to do this differently. I could have done this better. Right? You have to be willing, not on the first day, right? The first day, go out and have a glass of wine or whatever, commiserate with people, if you're going to feel bad, but then own it. That's just part of leadership. Accept that responsibility, figure out what has to happen next, and then move forward. And that is part of leadership to my mind because we all do that in a visible way. And when things go wrong and you wallow in it, you send a message to everybody else that the way we deal with setbacks is to wallow in misery for long periods of time. And that's not the way that we move forward with stuff.
You know, so one of the places where we're likely to wallow in a puddle of our own self-pity. This is not from personal experience.
So you've heard.
But I've heard.
I have this friend.
Is interviewing for a job. You know, like interviewing for a job is really hard. And as someone who I have done a lot of like side gigs, commercials and films and things and auditioning for things is honestly probably one of the most humiliating experiences of my life. Well, so how do you audition effectively?
Well, I mean, I think one thing you're saying about the idea of resilience, I mean, that word gets bandied around a lot, but I don't think people really delve deeply enough, as Art does in the book, about really what that means. You know, I think what's interesting, especially with the undergraduate students we work with, actually the graduate students too for that matter, I mean, many people come to new situations saying, I want to do everything I can to keep bad things from happening. And my goal is to have no bad things happen. Well, that goal is nuts because I don't care how hard you try to do that, some bad stuff's going to happen. So the thing to be thinking about is not how do I avoid situations that will be disappointing or somehow other than what I would like or that I planned, is thinking about how do I respond when things don't go as I planned and when things are surprising that I thought, well, this was going to happen. Look at that happen. Now, what am I going to do with that? And as Art's saying, it isn't reasonable to deny the fact that disappointment sucks and that you can be pissed off or just sad or whatever in response to things that don't go the way you would like them to go. But the real challenge in this is shifting attention away from how goals are set with the idea in mind, if my happiness, if I've now defined my happiness depending on this thing, and either this thing is going to make me happy, and if it doesn't happen, then I'm going to be miserable, you're going to be miserable a lot. And I think that's one of the
particularly
things.
Particularly because that thing won't make you as happy as you think it will.
Exactly, right? Even that too. But I think that aspect of the way you talk about this in the book really gives a perspective about the inevitable disappointments that are a part of the human experience, not just a relationship to work, but a relation to everything, you know? And I think being able to recognize feelings in response to disappointment and then recognizing that those feelings can be willed as temporary, and then we move on to whatever the next thing happens to be.
And then when it comes to interviews, I think there's two important things to keep in mind, right? One of which is we bring a frame to all these interviews that it's like an exam. You know, you're going to get a bunch of questions and you got to answer them right. There's a right answer and you've got to find it. And what we have to remember is that if you know, not everyone's getting brought into the interview, right? There's a whole virtual stack of applications that someone had to sift through, and a much smaller number of people are brought in for the interview, and so they already know a bunch about you. So now they're trying to figure out other stuff at the interview. And some of what they're trying to figure out is, like, are you somebody that they actually want to spend any time with? And so a lot of what you're trying to do in an interview is partly to engage with you. So don't think about it as an exam. Think about it as, I'm getting to know a colleague. It's a colleague in HR, but it's a colleague, and so I want to have this conversation, and I want to and so if somebody asks you a question that totally stumps you, you know, it's not like an exam where you go, I got to BS my way through this one, yeah. Right? Ask some questions, engage in a conversation, partly because one of the things you want to do is to learn about the organization. I mean, what if you get the job? You'd like to know what sort of place this is that you might want to work for. Well, if you get stumped, is this the sort of place that expects you to be a fully formed, fully molded human being on the day that you step in? I mean, that's horrible, right? Because there's a lot you need to learn when you get into a job. And so what you'd like is to be in a place where they're willing to bring you along and say, okay, I see, you know, I see maybe there was a little gap between what I asked and where you were. So let's negotiate this a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about what I meant. And you know, if you may learn about this firm that they're actually a place that wants to nurture you. You know, they're excited about your potential, not just everything that you're able to do. Because frankly, no matter what level you are, whether you're fresh out of college or applying for the CEO position of a company, there's a lot you need to learn. Because you don't know how that organization runs. Even CEOs who step in have a lot to learn about that organization in order to be effective leaders. Otherwise, you get what I sometimes call the Ron Johnson effect. You guys remember Ron Johnson? Architect of he developed the Apple Store. Awesome. Love the Apple Store. So what happened? JCPenney hired him to be their CEO. And rather than learning about the company and learning about the customers, he went, oh, same problem, same solution. Let's make JCPenney cool. What? So he didn't enter that with the assumption that he had to learn something in order to do that job. And that kind of, you know, you don't want organizations that expect you to do that. And frankly, organizations don't want anyone, really shouldn't want anyone, who thinks they have nothing to learn when they come there. And so interviews are very much about understanding that process.
And one thing that Art and I talk to our students about all the time, who are looking for jobs and interviewing and on the circuit and those kinds of things, is that you don't want somebody to hire the you pretend to be in an interview. You want somebody to hire you, because it's impossible to sustain a pretend you every day on a job. So when you have an opportunity to think about, I know what my strengths are, I know what I still have yet to learn, and I'm going to lay all that out because that's what I am. That's what I'm bringing to the company or to the institution or whatever it happens to be. And I think oftentimes, especially with younger people who are understandably generally less secure because they just have had less experience of this kind of thing, is they imagine, I have to imagine what this company wants or what this institution wants, and I have to make myself look like I'm that, which is not a bad goal until you want to make yourself look like that even beyond the level that you actually are that, right? And I think anytime you're entering into any new relationship, whether it's a business relationship, a personal relationship, we certainly want to put our best foot forward. I mean, that saying is still around for a reason, but not somebody else's foot. You know, I mean, my best foot, and my best foot has, you know, scuffs on it and things that aren't great, you know? And so if I recognize that I have a lot of things to offer, but I also, there are things, as Art's saying, in almost every job, I got to learn stuff. So my capacity to learn and adapt is a big part of my potential in a company. I'm going to think differently about what the interview's about and actually be much less nervous about the interview because I'm not imagining myself having to pretend to be something that I'm actually not.
And one other thing about interviews, just because this is, you know, in screenwriting, one of the things that they complain about is when you explain the plot rather than showing it, right? It turns out some of the same things apply in interviews. So if you're, when people interview, like, learn everything you can about the company and learn everything you can about some of the people there and learn everything you can about its history. Because if you go into an interview ill-prepared, like you're not sure what the firm does, and then you say, I'm the kind of person who goes above and beyond. You just told without showing, right? But if you come in and you know everything, then they're like, whoa, this person really prepares for stuff. And so they, you know, you can show a lot of what you're capable of just through things like the preparation that you put in.
Yeah. And I know, I think we're going to open things up for questions, like right now, Jack. So just raise your hand. And while he's coming around, here's the question. The work field is changing dramatically. You know, what work is changing daily. So how do you prepare yourself to adapt to that changing environment? What is the best way?
Well, let me say one quick thing about that, and then I'll go on for a long time about this, because I'll go on for a long time. I don't know. But I think, you know, a big thing about this, people talk a lot about resilience and flexibility and all those kinds of things. You know, it's now very common to say that the jobs that we're preparing many of our students for have not been created yet. You know, so what are we preparing them for? It's not like you're going to do this thing and we don't talk about it. Now, that's not true about everything, right? There are certain jobs that are going to be around, you know, for a very long time into the foreseeable future, even with automation, even with AI, even with all kinds of things. There are going to be some human jobs that need to be done by human beings. But I think one of the things that Art mentioned, not only tonight, but in several places in his book, is the capacity to learn. All of us, as new parents, recognize very quickly we don't know what the hell we're doing. We have this thing, I read the book, what's that? You know, what's he doing now? I don't know. You know, and I think the people who end up being successful parents are people who are willing to learn. They're willing to see surprises not as sources of panic, but as curiosities that require more investigation and more thought. And so that attitude about work and your work life, recognizing that, you know, there are skills that I have. I can read and understand manuals and those kind of things. I can communicate with people effectively. I can, if I recognize that there's a problem, I can sort of break the problem apart in a way that allows me to tackle it in a way that is often ultimately productive. That those kinds of things are generalizable across professions, applications, whatever it happens to be. And I think one of the things that is a challenge for people who are wedded to the idea that I'm going to go to school or I'm going to go to a vocational training thing and then I'm preparing to get that job and when I'm done with the training, I'll know exactly what to do, that is a fiction. And getting people to let go of that is a huge part of developing success in people.
You know, and I think we have to, we have, everyone's got to pay attention to the people around them. I mean, it's really important. So one of the things I talk about in the book a little bit is that you shouldn't have a mentor. You should actually construct a team of mentors. And don't, you know, most organizations are terrible at mentoring. You arrive and they don't know anything about you except that you just got hired and they assign you a mentor who's just somebody older who takes you out for coffee and you have coffee and you talk and you have a very pleasant conversation and then you never speak again. And but if they say, do you have a mentor? You say, yep, I got a mentor. And you ask the mentor, do you have a mentee? Oh, yeah. When was the last time you saw them? Oh, I don't know, maybe 3 years ago. What we want instead is something a little bit more organic, which is each of us should be empowered from the top down to find people who have various things we want and then to sit down with them and learn from them. You know, and I do say, right, that people like high in the organization, when somebody gets hired, they should take them out and talk to them a little bit about the company, but then say, look, I notice you're really good at, you know, social media or whatever it is, and I always wanted to learn something about that. Could you show me something? And what that says is everyone here is empowered to find something somebody else is good at and ask questions about it. So we want to empower people to do that. And then we want to be mindful of the kinds of things we should be paying attention to. So everyone should find somebody who has the career that they think they want and just pick their brain every once in a while, particularly because people who are really successful, often their favorite topic of conversation is themselves. So getting them to just talk about how they got where they are is easy, right? For the price of a cup of coffee, you can learn a ton. You also want to have people who've been around an organization for a while, who know where the bodies are buried, who know which office you're supposed to go to get something done. And you just want to, learn about the you know, forget the org chart. What's the org chart behind the org chart? You want those people who can help you with that. You need people who are good coaches. Right? Coaches, not advisors, right? So you don't want to go to somebody and say, what do I do here, and have them tell you? Because then you haven't learned anything except how to solve that problem. And what you really want is someone who's going to say, well, break this down for me a little bit and have, now you got to describe the problem a little bit more. Well, what do you think you ought to do? And walk you through the process of solving the problem, coaching you through that. So then the next time you hear their voice in your head, so you can solve that problem. So you want to find that team of people. And the reason you want this is because even though the workplace is changing rapidly, if you're paying attention to the people around you, you catch those changes. It's like being a sailor, you know, those, I mean, I don't know much about boats, but I know like a good sailor looks at the waves and sees a breeze coming and sees what's going to be happening. If you're paying attention to what's going on to the people around you, you can begin to see some of these trends before they affect you. As opposed to, you know, so I talk late in the book about like what happens when the choice to leave a job wasn't yours, right? Either because you got fired or because you got downsized or whatever it is. And honestly, if you totally missed the fact that your company was having significant financial problems, it's possible there were some things you should have been paying attention to earlier. Right? And so putting yourself in a position to learn to pay attention to what's going on around you helps you to prepare for that future.
Okay. So let's open things up for questions. There's one right up here. As we're doing that, I just want to have a huge shout out to my incredible intern who's selling books. Debbie, thank you.
Thank you.
Are there still books to sell after? Okay. Free shirt if you buy books. There it is. And Debbie will personalize them. I mean, Art will.
I will personalize. They're already signed, but I will write a note.
Okay. I can do that too, but my question is, I mean, you guys were talking about hedonism. It's not about.
Yeah. I'll give you a pen in case you want to personalize books. Yeah.
I've got a white pant. So, but what if your goals are? I mean, you have a job and you use that to fuel a lifestyle. I mean, you pay rent, you eat food, and whatever. But your goals are actually more spiritual. I mean, the reason you do the job is so that you can go to yoga, which is expensive, and go to meditation classes, which are not cheap, and then eat organic food at Whole Foods, which is not cheap again. You know, and what if those are your goals, and how does that reflect the fact that, you know, at work, you want to do well, but you don't want to be the VP of something, you know?
Yeah. So, well, let's just say a couple things about that. You know, I mean, certainly, it's an unfortunate reality in our country that it's expensive to do things that aren't prepackaged and frozen, whether it has to do with food or just spending time with people or that kind of thing. But I think, you know, one of the challenges of balancing life is figuring out how much money you need to actually do the things that matter to you. And whether it's the food you buy or whether you take classes in meditation or yoga or whatever. But the interesting thing to me, I know a lot of people, I know Art does too, I know Rebecca does too, who do their jobs so they can make money to do the things that they really want to do. And that's not uncommon. But one of the things that's, I think, an interesting goal to consider is how can I find a job that will pay me to do the things that I care about? And even though the remuneration from that job might not be as high as I could receive somewhere else, I mean, it's a really interesting thing. You know, when you think about people, if their only goal was to maximize their earning potential, that is, get the biggest check at the end of the month they could possibly get, many people would make different choices than they make right now. Now, granted, there are obligations that are inescapable about family and healthcare and all kinds of things that require you to meet some minimum threshold of income. But that threshold is lower than what most people think it is. And I think, as Art and I have spoken about on previous shows, and we've had these kind of conversations maybe even at Views and Brews before, you know, once you reach a threshold of income that allows you to get food and medical care and shelter and those kinds of things, increasing income above that has almost no correlation with a sense of well-being and happiness. And I think we are bombarded with ideas in the media that somehow the more money you get, the happier you're going to be. You're going to take a bigger vacation, a better vacation, a more extravagant vacation. You're going to buy better clothes, all those kinds of things. And actually, much of that is bullshit. I mean, in fact, you know, many of the things that we experience in life that are the most meaningful, and I think this is true across the spectrum of wealth, the things we experience are most meaningful are not wealth dependent, right? The interactions we have with human beings, whether they're our loved ones or people we interact with for the first time, the things that we do in our work, even our volunteer work perhaps, that we find meaningful and rewarding, that is almost completely divorced from what the numbers are in our bank balance. And that's an important thing to think about, because many of us are so just bombarded with counter messages that say, man, you got to be making more money. And to say to people, you could make more money, I mean, is a weird thing to say to people. You know, I mean, many people throughout my career, people have said that I should be an administrator, which is just horrifying to me because I find administrators not my favorite people generally.
It's horrifying to us.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I remember someone telling me, but you'd be so good at it. Why is that a reason to do it? You know what I mean? If I was in charge of restrooms at this university, we would have the best damn restrooms of any university in the country. But I don't want to do that either. You know what I mean? So the idea that you'd be good at something should be a criterion for why you would do it is the wrong criterion.
Yeah, I'm just gonna tell two quick things. So one is I often say this, but I do believe that the four saddest letters in the English language are TGIF. Right? If you work only to get to the end of the work week so that you can do the things you love, you're missing an opportunity. You know, and so to the extent that you can find, as Bob was saying, things that align with who you are as part of your workday, that's incredibly fulfilling. And it reminds me of a joke that I like to tell, but I always butcher it. So I'm gonna do my best with this one, right? But the joke goes something like: a guy gets his MBA, and to celebrate, he goes to the west coast of Mexico and takes a little fishing trip. So he's on the boat fishing with this guy, and he says, you know, this is a great setup you got here. I'll bet that if you got a small loan with the collateral that this boat provides, you could buy another boat, and then you could have two of these going out. And before long, you could probably buy four or six or eight of them. You could probably manage a whole fleet of these things and actually take over this industry along the entire west coast of the country. And the guy says, and why would I do that? He said, well, because after about 20 years, you could retire and then buy a boat and fish off the coast.
I mean, I think it's interesting, though, because it's difficult.
I got it this time.
It was a good one. You nailed it. You nailed it.
You did well. But it is hard when you know, you're in a society that has certain value systems. I mean, I can't tell you the amount of times when people said, oh, you're really good at radio, you should do television. And it's like, no, I want you to value radio as opposed to think I'd be more successful or successful at all if I was on television. Yeah. You know, so it's like you negotiate not only what your internal value systems are, but you're also having to negotiate these external value systems where you're validated. You know, you have to tell people, you know what, I want you to validate me for who I am. Yeah. I don't want to have to be the CEO to be valued
in
your organization.
And so to bring this full circle, we started with this discussion of these descriptors, right? So there's the independent and the interdependent self-construals. Okay? Now, one advantage of being more independent, like Bob,
adjectives,
is that you don't care as much what other people think of you. And the more interdependent you are, the more that some part of who you feel you are is bound up with the beliefs of other people. And so the more that, you know, and so what happens is, you know, the more that you think about yourself and think, yeah, I am deeply tied with all these other people, their opinions now matter. And one of the things you have to do at some point is to take a step back and say, okay, are their values my values? And if not, then you have to be willing, and this is hard, right? But you got to look in the mirror and you have to say, you know what? I'm doing this because I'm the one who has to go to work in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's an interesting thing. How much other people's attitudes toward us can potentially influence the decisions we make. And they often do so in ways that are not in our best interest. You know, I mean, if you're a capable person or you're an attractive person and people invite you to do things, what invariably happens, you'll be invited to do things that you really never would have chosen in a free operant. But somebody asked, and now you find yourself there. You know, when my daughter was dating, for those of you who have daughters and you lived through their dating, which was a horrifying experience. Anyway, you know, my daughter would come home and from a date, and I'd say, how'd it go? She said, good. And she said, I think he really likes me. Thinking, well, so what? Of course he's going to like you. Everybody likes you. So did you like him? I mean, and what does he like about you? Does he like the fact that you're kind? Does he like the fact that you're a good listener? Does he like the fact that, you know, or what's he responding to? And I think often we find ourselves in situations, and in the midst of the situation, we say, how did we get here? And it's because somebody else made an offer that we never would have been interested in if someone hadn't made that offer. And I think often human beings that find themselves in situations that they consider unsatisfying are dissatisfied precisely because they didn't choose that. The situation chose them. And I think one of the things that we do when we take time to be quiet and imagine, what do I really want for myself? What are the things that really matter to me? As Art said, what are my values? And then imagining, what are the circumstances that coincide with the values that I care about most? And then those are the things I'm going to pay attention to. And the fact that somebody says, you know, you could be an administrator, you know, really? And now you're an administrator. You think, how the hell did I become an administrator? Because somebody asked me. That's a terrible reason to become something, right? And if we think about, especially young people who are trying to find their way, who are capable, who are getting invitations from all kinds of people to do things, it's worth asking them and adults as well to slow down and say, what do I really want? And what is leading me to think this might be something I would choose over this? Is it the fact that they're interested in me, or am I really interested in them? Which is a different question.
We have to do another show on time and who owns our time. I mean, yeah. We will.
But because okay. She's the producer, and we do whatever Rebecca tells us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never with these two.
We are the
Nothing.
Masters of the long answer. There,
Jack is trying desperately to say we have another question. So,
hi, thank you. I first want to say that I love the podcast.
Thanks so much.
I got here a bit late, but I noticed that there's a lot of talk about the power of self. You know, exerting your individualism, being resilient, finding what really matters to you, and going with that. Right. But my question has a little bit more to do with, what about those times when we don't feel really strongly about something, where we're just going with, you know, what other people are defining for us? We're, you know, we're kind of on an autopilot, right? I get where in the beginning you may have other concerns outside of your locus of control that make you do something for financial reasons or something else. But then you get to a point where you kind of go with it, you have your 401k, you go on your vacations, and then you're just kind of going with it and not really making your autonomous decisions anymore. So my question is, what kinds of questions can you ask yourself to ground yourself in yourself, basically your values, right? Yeah. In, for example, I just want to bring up a point. When my parents went through 9/11, like, they seriously considered career change, right? My mom definitely did that. And I don't want, like, some calamity to be the cause of, like, being in the driver's seat of your life. So what are the questions that we can ask ourselves to remain grounded and keep true to our values?
Yeah, this is great. So chapter 9 is called move away, move on, or move up, right? Which is all about the sort of part of that process of having a career where you think about the next job. So move away is, I'm going to change careers entirely. Move on means I'm going to stick with my career path, but I'm leaving this firm and going somewhere else. Move up is I'm trying to move into another position within my organization. And one of the things I talk about, actually, is I have several stories of people whose decision to move away was precipitated by some kind of personal crisis. You know, the death of a family member, some other kind of tragedy. In one case, it was a friend of mine from high school I hadn't talked to in years, who changed careers in part because he'd gotten sick. And that caused him to rethink what he wanted to do. And you're absolutely right. Those kinds of moments, whether they're public tragedies like 9/11 or private ones like a death in the family or a serious illness of your own, can cause you to rethink where you are with respect to your values. But one of the things you can do is, there's a list of these values. You can actually say, where am I? How am I feeling about this? You can do this. I actually recommend not every day, because that's a little too much navel gazing. But you know, a lot of times in jobs you have a yearly evaluation you have to do. So the HR system is there. So turn that into a force for good. right? Which means actually look at what have I accomplished? What contribution have I made over the last year? And how do I feel about that? And if I project that out over the next 5 years, am I excited to do that? And do I feel like there's a path here that allows me to express some of the things that I do? And what that does is to force you out of the routine, because routine takes, we are habit creation machines, right? We you know, get up in the morning, the same breakfast I always make the coffee, walk the dog, feed the kid, get the kid to school, you know, and I do, and then it's the end of the, go meeting, end of the day, go home, make dinner, you know, and a weekend. So I can, you know, this stuff can happen, and a whole year can go, 2 years could go by. And so it's useful to create these moments where you pop out of that and ask questions like, how do I feel about this contribution that I'm making? Can this organization help me to make that contribution? Can this career path help me to do that? Are there people who are working here who can help to guide me? Do I need somebody else to guide me, whether it's a career coach or a spiritual advisor or try to diagnose those things that are missing, right? While there's time to do it. And the one last thing that's important to do, and we've talked about this on other shows, and this is the thing that actually drove me to take up the saxophone in my mid-30s, is you have to remember that when you get towards the end of your life, most of your regrets are going to be the things you didn't do, not the things you did. So you can take advantage of the remarkable human capacity to project yourself to the end of your life and then ask yourself, what will I regret not having done? And for me, when I was in my 30s, it was I would regret never having played the saxophone. And the next week, I went out to the old Straight Music when it was down on Fifth Street, and said, I want to buy a saxophone. It turned out I didn't want to buy a saxophone. I wanted a saxophone teacher, but that's a whole other story. But I'm in a band now, right? So you can do it, right? But you have to be willing to actually pop out of the daily grind and try and put it into a broader perspective.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when Rebecca wanted to do something about time again, which is certainly I'm all on that. You know, we seldom, I think, in our contemporary lives, spend time in quiet. Our minds are wonderful at figuring things out without our conscious direction. But what's required is quiet. And, you know, there was a wonderful op-ed writer, syndicated columnist named Sidney Harris, who wrote a number of years ago, I think he died in the late 90s or something. And he was commenting on people who, you know, the TV's always on in their house, there's always music going on, that kind of thing. And I'm not saying he was actually accurate in this, but what he said was so delightful. He said they had this constant din of stimulus merely to drown the dissonant hummings of their defective minds, which I thought it was kind of poetic. But I think, you know, many people have come to be uncomfortable with quiet. And I need to fill up this silence with something, you know, either voices or music or something, you know. And what, like I said, what's remarkable about human minds is the wanderings that human minds do are not random. The things that pop into our consciousness when we're not directing our minds to a particular goal are often very informative and very insightful, and that aspect of human experience is something that I think we have diminished the extent of in most of, because, you know, you get in a car, you turn the radio on, you turn something on, you know, you're at home and there's some media stream that's going, and I think any of us who spends time outside, I'm a runner. I don't run long, but I run every day. But when I run, you know, people say, why don't you have some earphones? I don't want anything. I'm just running this stuff around. You know, there are animals and trees and stuff, you know, and I just want to be outside. And what happens is that things occur to me, and I can't possibly explain why that popped into my head at that given moment. But I can be pretty confident in saying it wouldn't have popped into my head if there was other stuff being drilled into my experiences.
Who said digression is a form of secular revelation?
Well, that's lovely. Do you know that? No, I don't know that, but I should. That's lovely.
We should digress more.
To digress, yes. Yeah.
So we have time for one more question.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I feel like I had some really great action steps in terms of getting a mentor, also checking in with yourself and your values. But in those moments of feeling like you're faking it till you make it, that's what I hear a lot from people going into a new field. And it could be also like imposter phenomena. In those moments when like it's only you that's creating an upper limit for yourself, what's something you could do to reframe maybe? Or do you think that is an accurate perception that we have, this fake it till you make it, to grow? So yeah, when talking about growth and becoming what you want to become, what can we do in that little moment of like, does anyone know that I don't know, like, yeah. I haven't done it yet? Like, I haven't done that step yet.
So two things on this. One, you have to be willing to continually learn things. So I start early in the book. I talk about I drag my kids through the book in ways they haven't discovered yet because they haven't read it, but they're gonna find this out. And
they will.
And one of my kids actually he got offered a job that he was utterly unprepared for, and he said to me, he called me. He said, "What do I do?" I said, "Take it." I said to him, if you apply for a job you're completely ready for, you aimed too low. Okay? So we need to recognize that you grow into every new experience. And by the way, everyone else does as well. So now I also talk a lot about imposter syndrome, this idea, which comes from this idea in part that you look around and people don't wear their insecurities outside. So you just assume they've got it all together, right? I'm the only one who doesn't deserve to be here. Everybody else has got this thing nailed. No, nobody does. When my oldest son was a year and a half old and he woke up in the middle of the night throwing up all over the place and I cleaned it up and he gave me this look when I stepped in the room like, "Daddy's here, everything's gonna be okay." And I called my own father the next day. I said, "You had no idea what you were doing, did you? All those times that I looked at you, like you knew what you were doing. You were making it up as you went along." And he said, "Yes."
See, my kid at 5 months looks at me like, you don't know what you're doing.
But we look around and make assumptions about how competent everyone else is. We're all just trying to figure it out. And so the reason that imposter syndrome is so dangerous is because it leads you, if you think everyone else has it together and you don't, then you don't admit either to yourself or, more importantly, to other people that there are things you don't know how to do. And so you don't ask questions ahead of time, as opposed to just going to your boss and saying, "You know what, I'm not sure what to do here," and engaging in a conversation, because your boss wants to know that when you don't know how to do something, you're going to come and ask, because then they trust you. I can trust you to do something if I know that as soon as you feel out of your depth, you're going to come to me and ask for help, because now I can fix that. And it's much easier to fix that than to fix the mistakes you make because you were afraid to ask, because you were afraid to show that you don't know how to do stuff. So treat this as a collaboration, and recognize that any good supervisor, any good boss, is someone who wants to see you develop into the role and turn it into a collaboration.
You know, I think one of the things that sort of cultivates imposter syndrome is school, because school
hook 'em horns.
Hook 'em horns. Yeah. School seems to value errorless performance. And actually, you know, performance, even at the highest level, is full of error making. And I think the people who, you know, have what someone would describe as imposter syndrome, what they're afraid of, I'm going to make the mistake that's going to out me. You know, I'm going to make the mistake that reveals the fact that I'm not really as competent as people think I am. And I just tell you a quick story. One of my doctoral students, who's, by the way, who's defending her dissertation in 2 weeks, which is very good. I know, people do graduate. She has a job, all right? Anyway, her first year in school, she applied for some grant. It was some in-house university grant. And she misread the deadline, and it was actually at 5 o'clock. And she submitted the thing. She pressed the button at 7 or whatever it was, you know. So she came into my office the next day. She's crying. She said, I can't believe it. This happened. She's crying. She told me, you know, it was 5 o'clock. I presented her at 7, and, you know. And I said, I get that. Why are you crying? She said, well, I just feel terrible that I made a mistake like this. And I said, oh, you're going to make way worse mistakes than this. This is like nothing. So you know, and I think that acceptance of mistake making, I mean, I think what good supervisors, good mentors, good teachers, good parents do is alert everyone to the fact that mistake making is an ongoing human experience. And if your goal as an employee, as whatever, is to say, I'm going to do this errorlessly, you've just screwed yourself, because you're not. And once you start to accept the fact that you're not, and as Art's saying, when you don't know something, you say, God, I don't know this. That's a wonderful thing. And I think that we can do for our children and our students and our mentees and people who are trying to help along in life is to alert them to the fact that we don't know a lot of stuff. I mean, it's very easy as an ostensible expert to be misperceived as, you know, omniscient. And actually, we're way not, and all of us are learning all the time. And when learning becomes a part of your daily experience, you get better every day because you've learned a new thing. I didn't know this yesterday, and now I know this. So every day, I'm a better me because I learned something that I didn't know yesterday. That's a tremendously positive way to think about your life experience.
You know, that reminds me, Slavoj Žižek, everyone's favorite theorist, just gave a lecture on expertise as the new opioid of the masses.
There you go.
So I think that's, you know, it's a beautiful nice idea to admit you don't know, yeah, and expertise is kind of a myth sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Or expertise is continually discovering what you don't know and then filling that gap.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Well, this has been actually quite wonderful. There is so much we didn't talk about. You know, we didn't talk about boundaries and creativity.
Much of which, by the way,
is in a book that you can buy just outside.
And get a free shirt.
This is true. Thank you for coming out, and thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Bob, Duke, Art Markman.
Rebecca McElroy, genius.
Thank you. Have a wonderful night. Thank you.
Good night.